5. But he continued to look, and it was all as wonderful to him, and it moved him as it had when he was 18 years old and had seen it first, understanding nothing of it, and only knowing that it was beautiful. The winter had come very cold that year, and all the mountains were white beyond the plain. It was necessary for the Austrians to try to break through at the angle where the Sile River and the old bed of the Piave were the only lines of defense. If you had the old bed of the Piave, then you had the Sile to fall back on if the first line did not hold. Beyond the Sile, there was nothing but bare-assed plain and a good road network into the Veneto Plain and the plains of Lombardy. And the Austrians attacked again and again and again, late through the winter, to try to get onto this fine road that they were rolling on now, which led straight to Venice. That winter, the colonel, who was a lieutenant then and in a foreign army, which had always made him slightly suspect afterwards in his own army and had done his career no good, had a sore throat all winter. This sore throat was from being in the water so much. You could not get dry, and it was better to get wet quickly and stay wet. The Austrian attacks were ill-coordinated, but they were constant and exasperated, and you first had the heavy bombardment which was supposed to put you out of business, and then when it lifted, you checked your positions and counted the people. But you had no time to care for wounded since you knew that the attack was coming immediately. And then you killed the men who came wading across the marshes, holding their rifles above the water and coming as slow as men wade waist-deep. If they did not lift the shelling when it started, the colonel, then a lieutenant, often thought, I do not know what we would be able to do. But they always lifted it and moved it back ahead of the attack. They went by the book. If we had lost the old Piave and were on the Sile, they would move it back to the second and third lines, although such lines were quite untenable, and they should have brought all their guns up very close and whammed it in all the time they attacked and until they breached us. But thank God some high fool always controls it, the colonel thought, and they did it piecemeal. All that winter, with a bad sore throat, he had killed men who came wearing the stick bombs hooked up on a harness under their shoulders with the heavy calf-hide packs and the bucket helmets. They were the enemy. But he never hated them, nor could have any feeling about them. He commanded with an old sock around his throat which had been dipped in turpentine, and they broke down the attacks with rifle fire and with the machine guns which still existed or were usable after the bombardment. He taught his people to shoot, really, which is a rare ability in Continental troops, and to be able to look at the enemy when they came, and because there was always a dead moment when the shooting was free, they became very good at it. But you always had to count and count fast after the bombardment to know how many shooters you would have. He was hit 3 times that winter, but they were all gift wounds, small wounds in the flesh of the body without breaking bone. And he had become quite confident of his personal immortality since he knew he should have been killed in the heavy artillery bombardment that always preceded the attacks. Finally, he did get hit properly and for good. No one of his other wounds had ever done to him what the first big one did. I suppose it is just the loss of the immortality, he thought. Well, in a way, that is quite a lot to lose. This country meant very much to him, more than he could or would ever tell anyone, and now he sat in the car, happy, that in another half hour they would be in Venice. He took 2 mannitol hexanitrate tablets. Since he had always been able to spit since 1918, he could take them dry, and asked, How are you doing, Jackson? Fine, sir. Take the left outside road when we hit the fork for Mestre, and we'll be able to see the boats along the canal and miss that main traffic. Yes, sir, the driver said. Will you check me on the fork? Of course, the colonel said. They were coming up on Mestre fast, and already it was like going to New York the first time you were ever there in the old days when it was shining, white, and beautiful. I stole that, he thought. But that was before the smoke. We are coming into my town, he thought. Christ, what a lovely town. They made the left turn and came along the canal where the fishing boats tied up, and the colonel looked at them, and his heart was happy because of the brown nets and the wicker fish traps and the clean, beautiful lines of the boats. It's not that they are picturesque. The hell with picturesque. They are just damned beautiful. They passed the long line of boats in the slow canal that carried water from the Brenta, and he thought about the long stretch of the Brenta where the great villas were, with their lawns and their gardens, and the plane trees and the cypresses. I'd like to be buried out there, he thought. I know the place very well. I don't believe you could fix it, though. I don't know. I know some people that might let me be buried on their place. I'll ask Alberto. He might think it was morbid, though. For a long time he had been thinking about all the fine places he would like to be buried and what parts of the earth he would like to be a part of. The stinking, putrefying part doesn't last very long, really, he thought. And anyway, you're just a sort of mulch, and even the bones will be some use finally. I'd like to be buried way out at the edge of the grounds, but in sight of the old graceful house and the tall great trees. I don't think it would be much of a nuisance to them. I could be a part of the ground where the children play in the evenings, and in the mornings maybe they would still be training jumping horses, and their hooves would make the thudding on the turf, and trout would rise in the pool where there was a hatch of fly. They were up on the causeway from Mestre to Venice now with the ugly Breda works that might have been Hammond, Indiana. What do they make there, sir? Jackson asked. The company makes locomotives in Milan, the colonel said. Here they make a little of everything in the metallurgic line. It was a miserable view of Venice now, and he always disliked this causeway, except that you made such good time and you could see the buoys and the channels. This town makes a living on its own, he said to Jackson. She used to be the queen of the seas, and the people are very tough, and they give less of a good goddamn about things than almost anybody you'll ever meet. It's a tougher town than Cheyenne when you really know it, and everybody is very polite. I wouldn't say Cheyenne was a tough town, sir. Well, it's a tougher town than Casper. Do you think that's a tough town, sir? It's an oil town. It's a nice town. But I don't think it's tough, sir, or ever was. Okay, Jackson, maybe we move in different circles, or maybe we have a differing definition for the word. But this town of Venice, with everybody being polite and having good manners, is as tough as Cook City, Montana on the day they have the old-timers' fish fry. My idea of a tough town is Memphis. Not like Chicago, Jackson. Memphis is only tough if you're a Negro. Chicago is tough north, south. There isn't any east and west. But nobody has any manners. But in this country, if you ever want to know a really tough town, where they eat wonderfully, too, go to Bologna. I never was there. Well, there's the Fiat garage where we leave the car, the colonel said. You can leave the key at the office. They don't steal. I'll go in the bar while you park upstairs. They have people that will bring the bags. Is it okay to leave your gun and shooting gear in the trunk, sir? Sure. They don't steal here. I told you that once. I wanted to take the necessary precautions, sir, on your valuable property. You're so damned noble that sometimes you stink, the colonel said. Get the wax out of your ears and hear what I say the first time. I heard you, sir, Jackson said. The colonel looked at him contemplatively and with the old deadliness. He sure is a mean son of a bitch, Jackson thought, and he can be so goddamn nice. Get my and your bag out and park her up there and check your oil, your water, and your tires, the colonel said, and walked across the oil and rubber-stained cement of the entry of the bar. 6. In the bar, sitting at the first table as he came in, there was a post-war rich from Milan, fat and hard as only Milanese can be, sitting with his expensive-looking and extremely desirable mistress. They were drinking Negronis, a combination of two sweet vermouths and seltzer water, and the colonel wondered how much taxes the man had escaped to buy that sleek girl in her long mink coat and the convertible he had seen the chauffeur take up the long winding ramp to lock away. The pair stared at him with the bad manners of their kind, and he saluted lightly and said to them in Italian, "I'm sorry that I'm in uniform, but it is a uniform, not a costume." Then he turned his back on them without waiting to see the effect of his remark and walked to the bar. From the bar you could watch your luggage just as well as the two pescecani were watching theirs. "He is probably a commendatore," he thought. "She is a beautiful, hard piece of work. She is damned beautiful, actually. I wonder what it would have been like if I had ever had the money to buy me that kind and put them into the mink. I'll settle for what I have," he thought, "and they can go and hang themselves." The bartender shook hands with him. This bartender was an anarchist, but he did not mind the colonel being a colonel at all. He was delighted by it and proud and loving about it as though the anarchists had a colonel too, and in some ways, in the several months that they had known each other, he seemed to feel that he had invented, or at least erected, the colonel as you might be happy about participating in the erection of a campanile or even the old church at Torcello. The bartender had heard the conversation, or rather the flat statement at the table, and he was very happy. He had already sent down via the dumbwaiter for a Gordon's gin and Campari, and he said, "He's coming up in that hand-pulled device. How does everything go at Trieste?" "About as you would imagine."
"I couldn't even imagine."
"Then don't strain," the colonel said, "and you'll never get piles."
"I wouldn't mind if I was a colonel."
"I never mind it."
"You'd be overrun like a dose of salts," the waiter said.
"Don't tell the Honorable Pacciardi," the colonel said. He and the bartender had a joke about this because the Honorable Pacciardi was Minister of Defense in the Italian Republic. He was the same age as the colonel and had fought very well in the First World War and had also fought in Spain as a battalion commander, where the colonel had known him when he himself was an observer. The seriousness with which the Honorable Pacciardi took the post of Minister of Defense of an indefensible country was a bond between the colonel and the bartender. The two of them were quite practical men, and the vision of the Honorable Pacciardi defending the Italian Republic stimulated their minds. "It's sort of funny up there," the colonel said, "and I don't mind it."
"We must mechanize the Honorable Pacciardi," the bartender said, "and supply him with the atomic bomb."
"I've got three of them in the back of the car," the colonel said. "The new model, complete with handles. But we can't leave him unarmed. We must supply him with botulism and anthrax."
"We cannot fail the Honorable Pacciardi," the bartender said. "Better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep."
"Better to die on our feet than to live on our knees," the colonel said. "Though you better get on your belly damn fast if you want to stay alive in plenty places."
"Colonel, do not say anything subversive."
"We will strangle them with our bare hands," the colonel said. "A million men will spring to arms overnight."
"Whose arms?" the bartender asked.
"All that will be attended to," the colonel said. "It's only a phase in the big picture." Just then the driver came in the door. The colonel saw that while they had been joking, he had not watched the door, and he was annoyed always with any lapse of vigilance or of security. "What the hell's been keeping you, Jackson? Have a drink." "No, thank you, sir." "You prissy jerk," the colonel thought.
"But I'd better stop riding him," he corrected.
"We'll be going in a minute," the colonel said. "I've been trying to learn Italian from my friend here." He turned to look at the Milan profiteers, but they were gone. "I'm getting awfully slow," he thought. "Somebody will take me any day now. Maybe even the Honorable Pacciardi," he thought. "How much do I owe you?" he asked the bartender shortly. The bartender told him and looked at him with his wise Italian eyes, not merry now, although the lines of merriment were clearly cut where they radiated from the corners of each eye.
"I hope there is nothing wrong with him," the bartender thought. "I hope it to God or anything else. There's nothing really bad."
"Goodbye, my colonel," he said.
"Ciao," the colonel said. "Jackson, we are going down the long ramp and due north from the exit to where the small launches are moored, the varnished ones. There is a porter with the two bags. It is necessary to let them carry them since they have a concession."
"Yes, sir."
said Jackson. The two of them went out the door, and no one looked back at anyone. At the Embarcadero, the colonel tipped the man who had carried their two bags and then looked around for a boatman he knew. He did not recognize the man in the launch that was first on call, but the boatman said,
"Good day, my colonel. I am the first."
"How much is it to the Gritti?"
"You know as well as I, my colonel, we do not bargain. We have a fixed tariff."
"What's the tariff?"
3,500.
"We could go on the Vaporetto for 60.
"And nothing prevents you going?"
The boatman, who was an elderly man with a red but uncholeric face, said,
"They won't take you to the Gritti, but they will stop at the Embarcadero past Harry's, and you can telephone for someone from the Gritti to get your bags."
And what would I buy with the goddamn 3,500 lira? And this is a good old man.
"Do you want me to send that man there?"
He pointed to a destroyed old man who did odd jobs and ran errands around the docks, always ready with the unneeded aid to the elbow of the ascending or descending passenger, always ready to help when no help was needed, his old felt hat held out as he bowed after the unneeded act.
"He'll take you to the Vaporetto. There's one in 20 minutes.
"The hell with it," the colonel said. "Take us to the Gritti."
"Con piacere,"
the boatman said. The colonel and Jackson lowered themselves into the launch, which looked like a speedboat. It was radiantly varnished and lovingly kept, and was powered with a marine conversion of a tiny Fiat engine that had served its allotted time in the car of a provincial doctor and had been purchased out of one of the graveyards of automobiles, those mechanical elephant cemeteries that are the one certain thing you may find in our world near any populated center, and been reconditioned and reconverted to start this new life on the canals of this city. "How's the motor doing?" the colonel asked. He could hear her sounding like a stricken tank or a TD, except the noises were in miniature from the lack of power.
So-so, the boatman said.
He moved his free hand in a parallel motion. "You ought to get the smallest model Universal puts out. That's the best and lightest small marine engine I know."
"Yes," the boatman said. "There are quite a few things I should get."
"Maybe you'll have a good year."
"It's always possible. Lots of pescecani come down from Milano to gamble at the Lido. But nobody would ride twice in this thing on purpose. As a boat, it is fine, too. It is a well-built, pleasant boat. Not beautiful as a gondola is, of course. But it needs an engine."
"I might get you a Jeep engine, one that was condemned and you could work it over."
"Don't talk about such things," the boatman said. "Things like that don't happen. I don't want to think about it."
"You can think about it," the colonel said. "I'm talking true."
"You mean it?"
"Sure. I don't guarantee anything. I'll see what I can do." "How many children have you got?"
6. 2 male and 4 female.
"Hell, you mustn't have believed in the regime. Only 6.
"I didn't believe in the regime."
"You don't have to give me that stuff," the colonel said. "It would have been quite natural for you to have believed in it. Do you think I hold that against a man after we've won?" They were through the dull part of the canal that runs from Piazzale Roma to Ca' Foscari, though none of it is dull, the colonel thought. It doesn't all have to be palaces nor churches. Certainly that isn't dull. He looked to the right. The starboard, he thought. I'm on the water. It was a long, low, pleasant building, and there was a trattoria next to it. "I ought to live here. On retirement pay, I could make it all right. No greedy palace. A room in a house like that, and the tides and the boats going by. I could read in the mornings and walk around town before lunch, and go every day to see the Tintorettos at the Accademia, and to the Scuola San Rocco, and eat in good cheap joints behind the market, or maybe the woman that ran the house would cook in the evenings. I think it would be better to have lunch out and get some exercise walking. It's a good town to walk in. I guess the best, probably. I never walked in it that it wasn't fun. I could learn it really well," he thought, "and then I'd have that. It's a strange, tricky town, and to walk from any part to any other given part of it is better than working crossword puzzles. It's one of the few things to our credit that we never smacked it, and to their credit that they respected it.
Christ, I love it, he said, and I'm so happy I helped defend it when I was a punk kid, and with an insufficient command of the language, and I never even saw her until that clear day in the winter when I went back to have that small wound dressed and saw her rising from the sea. Merde, he thought. We did very well that winter up at the juncture.
I wish I could fight it again, he thought, knowing what I know now and having what we have now. But they'd have it too, and the essential problem is just the same, except who holds the air.
And all this time he had been watching the bow of the beat-up, beautifully varnished, delicately brass-striped boat, with the brass all beautifully polished, cut the brown water, and seen the small traffic problems. They went under the white bridge and under the unfinished wood bridge. Then they left the red bridge on the right and passed under the first high-flying white bridge. Then there was the black iron fretwork bridge on the canal leading into the Rio Nuevo, and they passed the two stakes chained together but not touching, like us, the colonel thought. He watched the tide pull at them, and he saw how the chains had worn the wood since he had first seen them. That's us, he thought. That's our monument. And how many monuments are there to us in the canals of this town? Then they still went slowly until the great lantern that was on the right of the entrance to the Grand Canal, where the engine commenced its metallic agony that produced a slight increase in speed. Now they came down and under the Academia, between the pilings where they passed, at touching distance, a heavily loaded black diesel boat full of cut timber, cut in chunks, to burn for firewood in the damp houses of the sea city.
That's beech, isn't it? The colonel asked the boatman.
Beech and another wood that is cheaper that I do not recall at this moment the name of.
Beech is to an open fire as anthracite coal is to a stove. Where do they cut that beech?
I am not a man of the mountains, but I think it comes from up beyond Bassano on the other side of the Grappa. I went there to the Grappa to see where my brother was buried. It was an excursion that they made from Bassano, and we went to the big Osario, but we returned by Feltre. I could see it was a fine timber country on the other side as you came down the mountains into the valley. We came down that military road, and they were hauling lots of wood.
And what year was your brother killed on Grappa?
In 1918. He was a patriot and inflamed by hearing D'Annunzio talk, and he volunteered before his class was called. We never knew him very well because he went so quickly.
How many were you in the family?
We were six. We lost two beyond the Isonzo, one on the Bainzizza, and one on the Carso. Then we lost this brother I speak of on the Grappa, and I remained.
I'll get you the goddamn jeep complete with handles, the colonel said. Now, let's not be morbid and look for all the places where my friends live.
They were moving up the Grand Canal now, and it was easy to see where your friends lived.
That's the house of the Contessa Dandolo, the colonel said.
He did not say, but thought, she is over 80, and she is as gay as a girl and does not have any fear of dying. She dyes her hair red, and it looks very well. She is a good companion and an admirable woman. Her palazzo was pleasant-looking, set well back from the canal with a garden in front and a landing place of its own where many gondolas had come in their various times, bringing hearty, cheerful, sad, and disillusioned people. But most of them had been cheerful because they were going to see the Contessa Dandolo. Now, beating up the canal against the cold wind off the mountains, and with the houses as clear and sharp as on a winter day, which of course it was, they saw the old magic of the city and its beauty. But it was conditioned for the colonel by his knowing many of the people who lived in the palazzos, or if no one lived there now, knowing to what use the different places had been put. There's Alvarito's mother's house, he thought, and did not say. She never lives there much and stays out at the country house near Treviso, where they have trees. She's tired of there not being trees in Venice. She lost a fine man, and nothing really interests her now except efficiency. But the family at one time lent the house to George Gordon, Lord Byron, and nobody sleeps now in Byron's bed nor in the other bed two flights below where he used to sleep with the gondolier's wife. They are not sacred nor relics. They are just extra beds that were not used afterwards for various reasons, or possibly to respect Lord Byron, who was well-loved in this town in spite of all the errors he committed. You have to be a tough boy in this town to be loved, the colonel thought. They never cared anything for Robert Browning, nor Mrs. Robert Browning, nor for their dog. They weren't Venetians no matter how well he wrote of it. And what is a tough boy? He asked himself. You use it so loosely you should be able to define it. I suppose it is a man who will make his play and then backs it up, or just a man who backs his play. And I'm not thinking of the theater, he thought, lovely as the theater can be. And yet, he thought, seeing now the little villa close up against the water, ugly as a building you would see on the boat train from Havre or Cherbourg, coming into the banlieue before Paris as you came into town. It was overrun with badly administered trees, and not a place that you would live in if you could help it. There he lived. They loved him for his talent, and because he was bad and he was brave. A Jewish boy with nothing, he stormed the country with his talent and his rhetoric. He was a more miserable character than any that I know, and is mean. But the man I think of to compare him with never put the chips on the line and went to war, the colonel thought. And Gabriele D'Annunzio, I always wondered what his real name was, he thought, because nobody is named D'Annunzio in a practical country, and perhaps he was not Jewish, and what difference did it make if he was or was not, had moved through the different arms of the service as he had moved into and out of the arms of different women. All the arms were pleasant that D'Annunzio served with, and the mission was fast and easily over, except the infantry. He remembered how D'Annunzio had lost an eye in a crash, flying as an observer over Trieste or Pola, and how afterwards he had always worn a patch over it, and people who did not know, for then no one really knew, thought it had been shot out at the Veliki, or San Michele, or some other bad place beyond the Carso, where everyone died or was incapacitated that you knew. But D'Annunzio truly was only making heroic gestures with the other things. An infantryman knows a strange trade, he thought. Perhaps the strangest. He, Gabriele, flew, but he was not a flyer. He was in the infantry, but he was not an infantryman, and it was always the same appearances. And the colonel remembered one time when he had stood commanding a platoon of assault troops while it was raining in one of the interminable winters when the rain fell always, or at least always when there were parades or speeches to the troops, and D'Annunzio, with his lost eye covered by the patch and his white face, as white as the belly of a sole new turned over in the market, the brown side not showing and looking 30 hours dead, was shouting, "Morire non ne basta!" And the colonel, then a lieutenant, had thought, "What the muck more do they want of us?" But he had followed the discourse, and at the end, when the lieutenant colonel D'Annunzio, writer and national hero, certified and true if you must have heroes, and the colonel did not believe in heroes, asked for a moment of silence for our glorious dead, he had stood stiffly at attention. But his platoon, who had not followed the speech, there being no loudspeakers then, and they being slightly out of hearing of the orator, responded as one man at the pause for the moment of silence for our glorious dead with a solid and ringing, "Evviva D'Annunzio!" They had been addressed before by D'Annunzio after victories and before defeats, and they knew what they should shout if there was any pause by an orator. The colonel, being then a lieutenant and loving his platoon, had joined with them and uttered, with the tone of command, "Evviva D'Annunzio!" thus absolving all those who had not. But now he was passing the house where the poor beat-up old boy had lived with his great, sad, and never properly loved actress, and he thought of her wonderful hands and her so transformable face that was not beautiful but gave you all love, glory, and delight and sadness, and of the way the curve of her forearm could break your heart, and he thought, "Christ, they are dead, and I do not know where either one is buried, even. But I certainly hope they had fun in that house." "Jackson," he said. "That small villa on the left belonged to Gabriele D'Annunzio, who was a great writer." "Yes, sir," said Jackson. "I'm glad to know about him. I never heard of him." "I'll check you out on what he wrote if you ever want to read him," the colonel said. There are some fair English translations.
Thank you, sir, said Jackson.
I'd like to read him any time I have time. He has a nice practical-looking place. What did you say the name was?
D'Annunzio, the colonel said. Writer, he added to himself, not wishing to confuse Jackson, nor be difficult as he had been with the man several times that day. Writer, poet, national hero, Fraser of the dialectic of fascism, macabre egotist, aviator, commander, or writer in the first of the fast torpedo attack boats, lieutenant colonel of infantry without knowing how to command a company nor a platoon properly, the great lovely writer of Notturno whom we respect, and jerk. Up ahead now there was a crossing place of gondolas at the Santa Maria del Giglio, and beyond was the wooden dock of the Gritti.
That's the hotel where we're stopping at, Jackson.
The colonel indicated the three-story, rose-colored, small, pleasant palace abutting on the canal. It had been a dependence of the Grand Hotel, but now it was its own hotel and a very good one. It was probably the best hotel if you did not wish to be fawned on or fussed over or over-flunkied in a city of great hotels, and the colonel loved it.
It looks okay to me, sir, Jackson said.
It is okay, the colonel said. The motorboat came gallantly up beside the piling of the dock. Every move she makes, the colonel thought, is a triumph of the gallantry of the aging machine. We do not have war horses now like old Traveler or Marbot's Lisette, who fought personally at Eylau. We have the gallantry of worn-through rods that refuse to break, the cylinder head that does not blow, though it has every right to, and the rest of it.
We're at the dock, sir, Jackson said.
Where the hell else would we be, man? Jump out while I settle with this sportsman. He turned to the boatman and said, That was 3,500, wasn't it?
Yes, my colonel.
I'll not forget about the overage jeep engine.
Take this and buy your horse some oats.
The porter who was taking the bags from Jackson heard this and laughed.
No veterinarian will ever fix his horse.
She still runs, the boatman said.
But she doesn't win any races, the porter said. How are you, my colonel?
I couldn't be better, the colonel said. How are all the members of the order?
All members are well.
Good, said the colonel. I will go in and see the Grand Master.
He's waiting for you, my colonel.
Let us not keep him waiting, Jackson, the colonel said. You may proceed to the lobby with this gentleman and tell them to sign me in.
See, the sergeant gets a room, he said to the porter. We're here for the night only.
The Baron Alvarito was here looking for you.
I'll find him at Harry's.
Good, my colonel.
Where is the Grand Master?
I'll find him for you.
Tell him I'll be in the bar. 7. The bar was just across the lobby of the Gritti, although lobby, the colonel thought, was not the accurate term to describe that gracious entrance. Didn't Giotto describe a circle, he thought? No, that was in math. What he remembered and loved best as an anecdote about that painter was, It was easy, said Giotto as he drew the perfect circle. Who the hell had said that and where? Good evening, Privy Councillor, he said to the barman, who was not a full paid-up member of the order, but whom he did not wish to offend. What can I do for you?
Drink, my colonel.
The colonel looked out of the windows and the door of the bar onto the waters of the Grand Canal. He could see the big black hitching post for the gondolas and the late afternoon winter light on the wind-swept water. Across the canal was the old palace, and a wood barge, black and broad, was coming up the canal, her bluff bows pushing up a wave even though she had the wind behind her. Make it a very dry martini, the colonel said. A double. Just then the Grand Master came into the room. He was wearing his formal attire as a head waiter. He was truly handsome as a man should be, from the inside out, so that his smile starts from his heart, or whatever is the center of the body, and comes frankly and beautifully to the surface, which is the face. He had a fine face with the long straight nose of his part of the Veneto, the kind, gay, truthful eyes, and the honorable white hair of his age, which was 2 years older than that of the colonel. He advanced, smiling, lovingly, and yet conspiratorially, since they both shared many secrets, and he extended his hand, which was a big, long, strong, spatula-fingered hand, well-kept as was becoming, as well as necessary to his position, and the colonel extended his own hand, which had been shot through twice and was slightly misshapen. Thus contact was made between two old inhabitants of the Veneto, both men and brothers in their membership in the human race, the only club that either one paid dues to, and brothers too in their love of an old country much fought over, and always triumphant in defeat, which they had both defended in their youth. Their handshake was only long enough to feel firmly the contact and the pleasure of meeting, and then the maître d'hôtel said, "My colonel." The colonel said, "Gran maestro." Then the colonel asked the Gran maestro to accompany him in a drink, but the maître d'hôtel said that he was working. It was impossible as well as forbidden. "Fornicate forbidden," said the colonel.
"Of course," the Gran Maestro said, "but everyone must comply with his duty, and here the rules are reasonable, and we all should comply with them, me especially, as a matter of precept."
"Not for nothing are you the Gran Maestro," the colonel said.
"Give me a small carpano punto y mezzo,"
the Gran Maestro said to the bartender, who was still outside of the order for some small, not defined, unstated reason.
"To drink to the ordine."
Thus, violating orders and the principle of precept and example in command, the colonel and the Gran Maestro downed a quick one. They did not hurry, nor did the Gran Maestro worry. They simply made it fast. "Now let us discuss the affairs of the order," the colonel said. "Are we in the secret chamber?"
"We are," said the Gran Maestro, "or I declare it to be such."
"Continue," said the colonel. The Order, which was a purely fictitious organization, had been founded in a series of conversations between the Gran Maestro and the Colonel. Its name was El Ordine Militar Nobile e Spirituoso des Caballeros de Brusadelli. The Colonel and the head waiter both spoke Spanish, and since that is the best language for founding orders, they had used it in the naming of this one, which was named after a particularly notorious multimillionaire non-tax-paying profiteer of Milan, who had, in the course of a dispute over property, accused his young wife, publicly and legally through due process of law, of having deprived him of his judgment through her extraordinary sexual demands. "Gran Maestro," the colonel said, "have you heard from our leader, the revered one?"
"Not a word. He is silent these days."
"He must be thinking."
"He must.
Perhaps he is meditating on new and more distinguished shameful acts."
"Perhaps. He has not given me any word.
But we can have confidence in him."
"Until he dies," the Grand Maestro said. "After that he can roast in hell and we will revere his memory."
"Giorgio," the colonel said, "give the Grand Maestro another short carpano."
"If it is your order," the Grand Maestro said, "I can only obey."
They touched glasses. "Jackson," the colonel called. "You're on the town. You can sign here for chow. I don't want to see you until 1100 tomorrow in the lobby, unless you get into trouble. You have money?"
"Yes, sir," Jackson said and thought. The old son of a bitch really is as crazy as they say, but he might have called me instead of shouting.
"I don't want to see you," the colonel said. Jackson had entered the room and stood before him at a semblance of attention. "I'm tired of seeing you because you worry and you don't have fun. For Christ's sake, have yourself some fun."
"Yes, sir."
"You understand what I said?"
"Yes, sir."
"Repeat it." "Ronald Jackson, T5 serial number 100768, will present himself in the lobby of this gritty hotel at 1100 tomorrow morning. I don't know the date, sir, and will absent himself from the colonel's sight and will have some fun, or," he added, "will make every reasonable attempt to attain that objective."
"I'm sorry, Jackson," the colonel said. "I'm a shit."
"I beg to differ with the colonel," Jackson said.
"Thank you, Jackson," the colonel told him. "Maybe I'm not. I hope you are correct. Now muck off. You've got a room here, or you should have, and you can sign for chow. Now try and have some fun."
"Yes, sir," said Jackson. When he was gone, the Grand Maestro said to the colonel,
What is the boy, one of those sad Americans?
Yes, the colonel said. And by Jesus Christ, we've got a lot of them. Sad, self-righteous, overfed, and undertrained. If they are undertrained, it's my fault. But we've got some good ones, too.
Do you think they would have done Grappa, Pasubio, and the Basso Piave as we did?
The good ones, yes, maybe better. But you know, in our army, they don't even shoot for self-inflicted wounds.
Jesus, said the Grand Maestro.
He and the colonel both remembered the men who decided that they did not wish to die, not thinking that he who dies on Thursday does not have to die on Friday, and how one soldier would wrap another's puttied leg in a sandbag so there would be no powder burns, and loose off at his friend from as far a distance as he figured he could hit the calf of the leg without hitting bone, and then fire twice over the parapet to alibi the shot. They had this knowledge shared between them, and it was for this reason, and for a true good hatred of all those who profited by war, that they had founded the order. They knew, the two of them, who loved and respected each other, how poor boys who did not want to die would share the contents of a matchbox full of gonorrheal pus to produce the infection that would keep them from the next murderous frontal attack. They knew about the other boys who would put the big 10 centime pieces under their armpits to produce jaundice. And they knew, too, about the richer boys who, in different cities, had paraffin injected under their kneecaps so that they would not have to go to the war. They knew how garlic could be used to produce certain effects which could absent a man from an attack, and they knew all or nearly all of the other tricks, for one had been a sergeant and the other a lieutenant of infantry, and they had fought on the 3 key points, Pasubio, Grappa, and the Piave, where it all made sense. They had fought, too, in the earlier stupid butchery on the Isonzo and the Carso, but they were both ashamed of those who had ordered that, and they never thought about it except as a shameful, stupid thing to be forgotten, and the colonel remembered it technically as something to learn from. So now they had founded the Order of Brucadelli, noble, military, and religious, and there were only 5 members.
What is the news of the order? The colonel asked the Grand Maestro.
We have ascended the cook at the Magnificent to the rank of Commendatore. He comported himself as a man 3 times on his 50th birthday. I accepted his statement without corroboration. He never lied, ever.
No, he never lied.
But it is a topic on which you must be chary in your credibility. I believed him. He looked ruined. I can remember him when he was a tough kid and we called him the Cherry Buster.
Anch'io.
Have you any concrete plans for the order during the winter?
No, Supreme Commander.
Do you think we should give an homage to the Honorable Pacciardi?
As you wish.
Let's defer it, the colonel said. He thought for a moment and signaled for another dry martini.
Do you think we might organize an homage and manifestation in some historic place such as San Marco or the old church at Torcello in favor of our great patron, Brucadelli, the revered one?
I doubt if the religious authorities would permit it at this moment.
Then let us abandon all ideas of public manifestations for this winter and work within our cadres for the good of the order.
I think that is soundest, the Grand Maestro said. We will regroup.
And how are you yourself?
Awful, the Grand Maestro said. I have low blood pressure, ulcers, and I owe money.
Are you happy?
All the time, the Grand Maestro said. I like my work very much, and I meet extraordinary and interesting characters. Also many Belgians.
They are what we have instead of the locust this year.
Formerly we had the Germans. What was it Caesar said? And the bravest of these are the Belgians, but not the best dressed. Do you agree?
I've seen them quite well costumed in Brussels, the colonel said. A well-fed gay capital, win, lose, or draw. I've never seen them fight, though everyone tells me that they do.
We should have fought in Flanders in the old days.
We were not born in the old days, the colonel said, so we automatically could not have fought then.
I wish we could have fought with the condottieri when all you had to do was outthink them and they conceded. You could think and I would convey your orders.
We'd have to take a few towns for them to respect our thinking.
We would sack them if they defended them, the Grand Maestro said. What towns would you take?
Not this one, the colonel said. I'd take Vicenza, Bergamo, and Verona, not necessarily in that order.
You'd have to take two more.
I know, the colonel said. He was a general now again, and he was happy. I figured that I'd bypass Brescia. It could fall of its own weight.
And how are you, Supreme Commander?
The Grand Maestro said, for this taking of towns had pulled him out of his depth. He was at home in his small house in Treviso, close to the fast-flowing river under the old walls. The weeds waved in the current, and the fish hung in the shelter of the weeds and rose to insects that touched the water in the dusk. He was at home, too, in all operations that did not involve more than a company, and understood them as clearly as he understood the proper serving of a small dining room or a large dining room. But when the colonel became a general officer again, as he had once been, and thought in terms that were as far beyond him as calculus is distant from a man who has only the knowledge of arithmetic, then he was not at home, and their contact was strained, and he wished the colonel would return to things they both knew together when they were a lieutenant and a sergeant.
What would you do about Mantova? The colonel asked.
I do not know, my colonel. I do not know whom you are fighting, nor what forces they have, nor what forces are at your disposal.
I thought you said we were condottieri, based on this town or on Padova.
My colonel, the Grand Maestro said, and he had diminished in no way. I know nothing, truly, about condottieri. Not really how they fought then. I only said I would like to fight under you in such times.
There aren't any such times anymore, the colonel said, and the spell was broken. What the hell? Maybe there never was any spell, the colonel thought.
The hell with you, he said to himself. Cut it out and be a human being when you're 50 years old.
Have another Carpano, he said to the Grand Maestro.
My colonel, will you allow me to refuse because of the ulcers?
Yes, yes, of course.
Boy, what's your name, Giorgio? Another dry martini. Secco, molto secco e doppio.
Breaking spells, he thought. It is not my trade. My trade is killing armed men. A spell should be armed if I'm to break it. But we have killed many things which were not armed. All right, spellbreaker, retract.
Grand Maestro, he said. You are still Grand Maestro and fornicate the condottieri.
They were fornicated many years ago, Supreme Commander.
Exactly, the colonel said.
But the spell was broken.
I'll see you at dinner, the colonel said. What is there?
We will have anything you wish, and what we do not have I will send out for.
Do you have any fresh asparagus?
You know we cannot have it in these months. It comes in April and from Bassano.
Then I'll just urinate the usual odor, the colonel said. You think of something and I'll eat it.
How many will you be? The maître d'hôtel asked.
We'll be two, the colonel said. What time do you close the bistro?
We will serve dinner as late as you wish to eat, my colonel.
I'll try to be in at a sound hour, the colonel said.
Goodbye, Grand Maestro, he said, and smiled, and gave the Grand Maestro his crooked hand.
Goodbye, Supreme Commander, said the Grand Maestro, and the spell was existent again and almost complete. But it was not quite complete, and the colonel knew it, and he thought, why am I always a bastard, and why can I not suspend this trade of arms and be a kind and good man as I would have wished to be? I try always to be just, but I am brusque and I am brutal, and it is not that I have erected the defense against brown-nosing my superiors and brown-nosing the world. I should be a better man with less wild boar blood in the small time which remains. We will try it out tonight, he thought. With whom, he thought, and where, and God help me not to be bad.
Giorgio, he said to the barman, who had a face as white as a leper, but with no bulges and without the silver shine.
Giorgio did not really like the colonel very much, or perhaps he was simply from Piemonte and cared for no one truly, which was understandable in cold people from a border province. Borderers are not trusters,
and the colonel knew about this and expected nothing from anyone that they did not have to give.
Giorgio, he said to the pale-faced barman, write these down for me, please.
He went out, walking as he had always walked, with a slightly exaggerated confidence, even when it was not needed, and in his always renewed plan of being kind, decent, and good, he greeted the concierge, who was a friend, the assistant manager, who spoke Swahili and had been a prisoner of war in Kenya and was a most amiable man, young, full of juice, handsome, perhaps not yet a member of the order, and experienced. And the Cavaliere Ufficiale who manages this place, he asked, my friend?
He is not here, the assistant manager said. For the moment, naturally, he added.
Give him my compliments, the colonel said, and have somebody show me to my room.
It is the usual room. You still wish it?
Yes. Have you taken care of the sergeant?
He is well taken care of.
Good, said the colonel.
The colonel proceeded to his room, accompanied by the boy who carried his bag.
This way, my colonel,
the boy said when the elevator halted with slight hydraulic inaccuracy at the top floor.
Can't you run an elevator properly? The colonel asked.
No, my colonel, the boy said. The current is not stable.